citizens of New York. Perceptions of the world has been detected by a group of extraordinary men and women who have dedicated themselves to fighting crime. The world's mightiest warrior.
He has powers far beyond the capabilities of mere earth.
In the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's a duck.
Welcome to the Marvel Miscellaneous Rejects, the beginning of Percolated Media's look at the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
If you consider it kick-ass, we'd be honored to have you join us.
Join Garrett.
Every duck's got his limit. And you scum have pushed me over the line.
Matt.
I'd appreciate it enormously if you could just leave us in peace until I finish this lovely pint of Guinness.
And Adam.
What I don't know is what the hell I'm doing here.
As they start their comic book movie dive by reviewing the misfits of the Marvel movies.
Oh, don't scare me with that hocus pocus, boy.
Included in this part of the Marvel retrospective is Howard the Duck.
It's Howard, thank you.
Dr. Mordred.
I thought you'd never get back. This guy says he's on a mission from his master to kill you.
His master's dead.
Man-Thing.
I guess it didn't fill you in all the way.
The Kick-Ass films.
Just because you dress like us doesn't mean that you can be like one of us.
Big Hero 6.
Hello, I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
And the Kingsman movies.
You break the law, you pay the price.
Be sure to keep checking the site, as the boys will, from time to time, come back to continue going through the entire slate of Marvel movies up until they catch up on the MCU proper.
Thanks for not giving up on me.
So sit down and open up your favorite Marvel comic, Percolated Media listeners.
They get the cover of Life Magazine, man! Life Magazine? Life Magazine went out of business, you fucking idiot!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, Marvel Retrospective, begins now.
Are we going to stand around here all day? Or are we going to fight?
The King's Man. Released December 22nd, 2021. Budget of about $100 million. Box office take of $126 million. Ouch. This was directed by Matthew Vaughn. So, is this the laziest title we have ever seen in this retrospective's history, where they just played around with punctuation to make a new movie?
It's up there.
I guess, what do you do after a second movie that made just as much money as the first one did, but didn't necessarily light the world on fire the same way? You go back to the drawing board and go back in time, which is nothing new with these types of franchises. Certainly not with Matthew Vaughn, because you could argue X-Men First Class is technically a prequel, but talking about X-Men continuity is about as confusing as trying to explain what happens in this movie.
Boy, you're not kidding. I get going this route. I really do. You want to go to where it's established. But I even watched the trailers for this before we started recording, and there's not even any of the Matthew Vaughn vintage direction or comedy. But the exception of Rasputin, this has absolutely no touches of what we've seen before. Maybe that's intentional. I'll discuss that as we get deeper into film. I have theories as to why it went this route, but I was not expecting what we were about ready to watch when we ended last week's show.
You know, we talked about how in the last one, in Golden Circle, he was infuriated that marketing spoiled so much of that film. And I think the way that this is done, this feels like he completely took control of the narrative on how to put out the trailers and teases and such. Because there's twists, there's turns, and there's stuff that I never saw coming. And for one of the first times ever, none of that is really spoiled when you look at the trailers and marketing. As opposed to Golden Circle, that completely just opened their trench coat and showed you it all.
So I have a lot to say about the trailer, first and foremost, because this came out during the pandemic still, and there were not a lot of movies coming out consistently. This trailer seemingly played in front of every single movie that I went to go see in the theater, which was basically once every 2 weeks.
Yeah, this trailer played a lot. This release was delayed, what, 6 months or something, right? This was like the fourth release date or something like that?
Well, originally supposed to come out in 2019. This was shot and done with a November 8th, 2019 release. Then they pushed it back a week. Then they pushed it to 2020. And then COVID happened. And then the Fox being bought out by Disney happened, which also put this on the back burner because Disney also had to shift back their entire Marvel. That takes precedent over anything they acquired from Fox. So they moved it back up, and then they delayed it again. Eventually, this thing moved around as much as the soldiers did in World War One, and it only played for about 6 weeks before going straight to digital, which I think explains why this movie bombed. But also, they put this out when Spider-Man No Way Home was the most successful movie, not just of the pandemic, but since Avengers Endgame. I think it's like the third highest grossing movie ever made.
Yeah, very bizarre opening weekend. You said it was released like the 22nd of December?
Yeah, it came out the same weekend as The Matrix Resurrection.
That's crazy. That's crazy for the studio. That is literally shitting it out is what it is. It's like, we got to get rid of this somehow. We just might as well just dump it on this day.
Yeah, it's like a tax write-off.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get it out. And I was lukewarm on the Golden Circle, as we all were to varying degrees. But I kind of, if I'm going to play the, what's the opposite of devil's advocate? I'm going to play the good cop and say, I accuse the second one of going too far into downright buffoonery and outlandishness. So seeing the trailers that were considerably more toned down and playing into my soft spot for historical fiction, I could see why they went down this road beyond just, oh, we're going to make a prequel without any of the existing cast.
But World War One? Nobody wants to talk about World War One.
Well, it became okay to do World War One because Wonder Woman showed you could do it and people would go see it.
Yeah, 1917 was World War One, but those didn't really get into the conflicts, though. What was the conflict of World War One? We knew the conflict of World War Two. World War One was just kind of a bunch of people griping with each other and all of a sudden bust into a war. There was no real cinematic thing that springboarded this war into existence. So the fact that he went all the way back to World War One was baffling to me.
To me, it would be baffling for an American director to do it, an American writer to do it, because World War One, the way we're involved, it's not, I hate to say it's not our war, because every war is our war, but this really was Europe, Africa, those areas. I do think that it, British history really keys in on World War One quite a bunch. This movie takes a lot from Wonder Woman. We'll get into it later on. It rips off Wonder Woman at some parts. But I do think that he has something to say, and maybe about the confusion and misremembering and the fact that a lot of people don't know World War One history. They don't know what preceded it. It's a joke in other movies, you know, about what started World War One, because it's almost lost to history even now, only 100 years later. I'd rather that than yet another World War II movie. I mean, even video games, I'm like, just get away from World War II already. So if there was someone to do it, I think he could. I was just kind of shocked that that's where this prequel was going to go. But I was ready for one to tell the foundations and what laid the stepping stones for Kingsman down the road. And yeah, to Matt's point, that the trailer played it pretty straight, I was impressed with, because the initial reveal that we were going to do a prequel, not excited. I just did not care until I saw what they were doing with it.
Boy, I would have loved to have seen a movie that laid the foundation for what was to come, because, spoiler alert, this movie doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't until the last 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It pulls what George Lucas did at the end of Revenge of the Sith, where it's, oh, we got to wrap all this shit up quick. One thing, I was more excited for that because, much like Adam, World War II has been done to death, not just in film in general, but you look at this type of like stuff like Captain America, which is certainly more, much like this, it's historical fiction in a lot of ways, taking liberties, but even like Indiana Jones, you look at the Raiders and Last Crusade and how those use World War II as a backdrop to certain ways, even though they take place at the time when the war was about to break out, not necessarily the battles itself. So I could see the practice, but I just could not get Wonder Woman out of my head. I think that's the only reason this got the green light to be set in this period, was because that movie did so well. With that being at the forefront, I mean, that movie is a superhero movie, but they don't, I mean, for a PG-13 movie, they do their best to show how awful World War One was if you were on the front lines. And with this, The only things that really got me excited were the cast. I thought the people they got to be in this are all highly respected actors, and Ralph Fiennes is certainly not, much like Colin Firth, not someone I would suspect of leading this type of action movie, but he's also, he's always been very good, I think, about, with the exception of the Avengers, which everybody gets a mulligan, he's been very good about what franchises he associates himself with.
I don't know. He associates himself with Hannibal.
True, but that, look at Dragon. Yeah, but look at the cast for Red Dragon. It's not like he was in bad company. You know, Harry Potter, he was already, well, he's firmly established as M by this point with James Bond. There's a Bond girl in this movie from the Daniel Craig era.
This is a guy that came out of the gate, and when most people saw him right away, I mean, it was Oscars, and he's done almost everything since. He brings a level of respectability and authority to whatever role he shows up in.
And he's certainly the, like, if you're thinking of Kingsman as the prototypical, like, classy gentleman, I could see how this guy, this actor, would be one of the founding members. Obviously, if you can't like, DH Michael Caine.
Well, if you'll recall, I remembered him actually being in the first film when we were getting ready to do this series. That's how much of an, I shouldn't say non-fan, because I was a big fan of the first film, but that's as much as I did, as I remembered about it, was I thought I remembered what Ralph Fiennes being in the series before he got into this prequel, but no, you pointed out that he's actually in this one, so I was looking forward to seeing him, I'll say that. But really, in looking at this cast, I mean, goddamn, wait, Ralph Fiennes or whatever the hell, like,
Ralph Fiennes,
like, I hadn't seen him since Amazing Spider-Man and The Lizard, for Christ's sake. A really bizarre cast he's assembled for this.
But I do think it's one of those where you get known and you have actors that want to work with you because of the type of sets you run, the type of films you put out. And I do think you get that opportunity that people are like, yeah, I want to come work with you. Nolan gets it for the notoriety and for the quality and for the Oscar buzz that he gets. And I do think that he gets here because he's fun. And I do think these were fun British movies that he put out, the first two. As much as there was quality differences, I think they were well received as a good time.
Yeah, and I heard no, like, bad blood from actors who had difficult experiences working on those sets outside of Channing Tatum, but that's probably just because he got pulled away due to other commitments. The other thing that gave me pause for concern is Jane Goldman is not credited as a writer whatsoever. And we got the writer of Adam's favorite movie, Oblivion, and The November Man, which is...
Oh, my God.
I wanted that to be good because it looked like one of the best, like, non-Bond Brosnan movies, stuff like The Matador and Tailor of Panama, but sadly it was not up to par.
Yeah, I think I only watched that once and it kind of literally rushed over me. I don't even remember it, honestly.
And speaking of Ralph Fiennes, I love how this movie opens. I thought we were watching The English Patient.
Yeah, same here.
So the movie opens in 1902, turn of the century. Now, if you know your history at all, this is basically right after the South African War with the British Empire and the Boer Republics, where we meet Orlando, who's played by Ralph Fiennes. He's with his family. It's important to note he's not a soldier. He's with the Red Cross, the British version specifically, with their young son and their, I guess, manservant?
Yeah, what is butler? This?
Yeah, it's funny that for the things that this wants to address, that, let's be honest, this was a indentured servant would probably be being nice.
What is it with Jaimin Hatsu getting in all these big movies, but he gets nothing to do? Especially because this movie is definitely trying to make various social statements, in particular with not just class, but there is a racial component here. But it's all surface level, which I really think the second movie suffered from, especially with what it was trying to say about the war on drugs and all that nonsense. Whereas here, you have a historical backdrop to use precedent and address what was happening at the time. But like a lot of things, including the characterizations, it's underdeveloped.
Very underdeveloped. And I think this movie, I'm just going to come right out of the gate with this. We talked about how the trailer didn't really have any of Matthew Vaughn's style, and this feels like a restrained Matthew Vaughn in this movie. We will barely see any hints of what we saw in the previous two films. I think this is him trying to make his Saving Private Ryan. I think this is him trying to make his historical drama. You said it was historical fiction, which it kind of is, but there are things in here where he goes to the T and puts things out there that actually happened in this movie, and it's really funny to see a director try to go this route with this franchise. And right out of the gate, I gotta say, I was kind of turned off as to what I was seeing at this meeting take place, and you know where it's going to go. And I found none of Vaughn's style in almost any of this film.
You wonder if some of this stuff, especially here, the Second Boer War, the South African War, I wonder if this plays to a different audience across the pond than it does here. As an ignorant American, I don't know these battles. I don't know this. I'm ignorant to it all. So trying to get me to care, it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I fault that to my own ignorance that I don't know the history because it's not my history. But I wonder if it plays better for a European audience.
But you see the inverse of that perspective with how they portray Wilson and his administration in this movie, where it's very, yep. I don't want to say ignorant, but it's very nearsighted with how it depicts Americans. So I do think it is just a lack of context for both parties involved. But I was thinking of The English Patient because this looks like, I think that takes place in Africa partially. I mean, that movie's so fucking long, I don't even remember. But also watching Ralph Fiennes, of all people, walk through a concentration camp.
Yeah.
Yes. Have immediately Schindler's List flashbacks, mm-hmm. except he's on the good side here, where he tries to talk to this general, but a sniper attack breaks out, and because this is a comic book movie, we have to have a tragic backstory, and as soon as she showed up, I'm like, yep, the wife's getting shot.
That's exactly what I said. She comes out in that dress, I'm like, fuck, yeah, I knew she was going to get shot as well. And I'm not faulting him for it. You got to have a springboard for your characters, but yeah, it's not like you couldn't call this.
And on the bright side, we're talking literally like 4 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
I didn't know which one of them it was going to be. I thought it could have been the son, but yeah, the wife makes the most sense.
And she says before she dies, I mean, this is as melodramatic as it gets. You have to promise me that, you know, our son will never see her again. They do some de-aging on Ralph Fiennes. It's still got that, a little bit of that uncanny valley, but it looks like they just took the wrinkles away.
I honestly had no idea that they did de-age him, so good call on that. I didn't catch that.
And on the back of her jacket is where the logo comes from, because mm-hmm. I thought that was a pretty cool transition. And we cut to 12 years later, so if you know your history, you know World War I is on the brink of starting, and Orlando is royalty, you know, he's the Duke of Oxford, got his own mansion. We're introduced to him and his son, but like Han Solo, wants to be a pilot, but he also wants to be a soldier. And this is distracting, because this actor was in 1917.
And I never get on this actor's side. I was really missing Eggsy in this movie, and this is a big flaw of this movie, is putting this kid in this role. And it took me at least half of the movie from a couple weeks ago to actually really get on Eggsy's side. I never get on this guy's side. In Orlando, being in this mansion and everything, like, there's nobody for me to really grasp onto here except for the director, who I think is trying to show me a historical drama. So I'm baffled as to the franchise that I thought I was going to see a prequel to, instead being a completely different film.
Yeah, part of the problem is with those first movies, it was about not everybody has to be in their ruling class to be able to do this. But you take that away because we're now founding it. So therefore, the founding members do need to be in that ruling class. But we've been taught that it's not about the ruling class. So it's a weird juxtaposition because we're taught to not like these people later in the role of Eggsy.
Right, because the first film, there is a very strong statement about class, and mm-hmm. what you're born into does not automatically give you privilege, so to speak. It is something you can earn and attain versus something you have. But also, all their conversations hit the exact same beats. I want to go to war. No. End scene. Until they contrive a way for him to get into the war, which I have many critiques of when we get to that. And also, this actor can't hold his own against Ralph Fiennes. It feels like a real mismatch of talent. Mm-hmm. Not that Ralph Fiennes is amazing in this, but I think he's pretty committed.
But Ralph Fiennes has an established presence, though. And the problem is this kid has none. So you're right. Even Taron Egerton was able to play second fiddle to Colin Firth very well, and he was able to stand toe-to-toe with him. This kid, he cannot stand toe-to-toe with Ralph Fiennes, and even when we see him fake fighting in a little bit, I don't get any set of presence or any set of ways that this guy can stand up to Ralph Fiennes in any way in this movie.
Yeah, this father-son dynamic, it does not carry the way that it needs to. I really don't care about it. Mm-hmm. Even after the loss of a mother, which I guess is only there to make us try to care about these two, but I just don't.
It's there to draw the wedge between them.
Yeah.
Like, I'm fine with these tragic backstories, but you've got to have more dimension to them than just what's at face value. So Orlando comes home. He calls one of his maids, played by Gemma Arterton, who she is a Bond girl.
Mm-hmm. Strawberry Fields Forever.
Albeit in Quantum of Solace, which is why nobody remembers she was a Bond girl. I like her presence. She's a lot of fun, but much like Jaimin Hansu, most of the movie she just stands there.
Yep. That's my exact note as well. She doesn't do much. I don't agree with you. I don't think she has any presence. Even when she was in Bond, I mentioned in that podcast that she had almost zero presence in that as well. Yeah, I get nothing from her at all.
I think she is having the most fun.
Wow.
One, I liked her as a Bond girl. I thought Strawberry Fields, like that whole...
because you're like, you got a fetish for redheads.
Yeah, you sure as hell do. Matt, you have no idea how fucking true that statement is.
There's something about her smile, her charm. I think she's having fun. And this film needs more fun from some of its lead characters. So I don't think she's in it enough for me.
I think there's one person in this cast who's having too much fun, which we'll talk about momentarily.
Yes.
One of the things that this movie continues from The Golden Circle is this thing is a tonal mishmash to the point where I feel like I'm watching five different movies. Not just because this plot is so thinly veiled. The twists in here that are all executed just make me shrug my shoulders. I find a lot of the plotting in this to be really sloppy. But also, this movie goes from being a legitimate World War I film to a Russian ballet-filled cartoon that might as well be out of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
I don't think it's as drastic as last week's film, though.
No, it's not as cartoonish. Like, there's no robot dumps or anything like that. I still don't feel like this blends together as well as the first one does.
It's not as cartoonish, but it's more whiplash-inducing when they come because it just goes back and forth in different ways.
Matt, did you see this in theaters?
Set the tone.
I watched this at home.
You watched this at home, okay. Adam, did you see this in theaters?
No, I didn't. And you know the reason? Because you're going to release this freaking Christmas week.
Yeah.
So I didn't see it Christmas week. I didn't see it through New Year's. And then suddenly it only had a few more weeks to play. And then the time frame, it's only playing twice a day. So no, I mean, they screwed themselves because I did want to watch it in theaters. But absolutely piss poor schedule by Disney Fox trying to just get this out of the way.
Orlando takes his son to the Kingsman Tailor Shop, which is functioning as what it was designed to do even 100 years before the first one. We're introduced to Charles Dance as one of the generals who... This is one of the only movies where he doesn't play a villain in some capacity.
My dear brother Moopsie, we just talked about him when we did Alien 3 last year. Charles Dance just keeps popping up. Very unrecognizable. It took me a couple head tilts to really see that it was him.
Well, yeah, because this movie is like it's like Justice League where it's mustache porn. And this is where, like, if you know your European history, which I'm kind of ignorant on, you know, he was the actual Secretary of State for War. He was actually lost at sea. So there are components that are playing with history. I mean, some of it's really exaggerated, which we'll talk about momentarily. But Orlando forbids his son to join the army, and he tells Kitchener, don't let my son go to war no matter what. And as soon as I saw his second in command, I'm like, all right, if there's a villain in this movie, it's got to be this guy because he plays the villain in everything.
Yeah, that's as on the nose as getting Daniel Brühl to be in this thing. The surprise element is lost.
Well, I have a lot to say about that in the next scene because we cut to Matthew Vaughn does get his Bond input here because this might as well be a volcano lair. It's on the top of the mountain. They are basically Spectre because they have rings, they have code names. You have a leader, a bald leader in the shadows. It's the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but instead of public domain characters, it's all like a real life rogues gallery.
God damn it, you took my fucking line. That was my exact note, was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Includes Rasputin, played by unrecognizable Rhys Ifans.
Who is the highlight of the film for me? I will put that out there right now. This movie needed a jolt, and every time he is on screen, I'm smiling. Which, when we eventually get to Spider-Man 16 years down the line, we'll get to Rhys Ifans in a role that I didn't like him in, which was Amazing Spider-Man, but as the Lizard. But here, I dig him every time he's on screen, man. He just lights it up, and he goes all out for it, and much like he did when he got kicked out of Comic-Con one year, he's going full tilt and he's having a blast. So, and as am I when he's on screen.
I like him until I don't, because I do think that this character goes a little too far and has a little too much fun, but he's gonna give his all. He's wiry. I can't help but like Rhys Ifans, but eventually this character overstays its welcome.
Fair enough.
You say that because he dies at the halfway point.
Yes, he overstays his welcome.
I don't think it's a overstays his welcome. I just think they go too far with playing up the reputation that the real life guy had, because he was into the occult. He was a mystic. as far as him being like a sexual predator and borderline pedophile, which they insinuate, I don't know if there's any proof to that. He is Baron Samedi. He's a witch doctor.
I feel like they filmed a 5-hour movie and really just cut together the parts that he wanted to.
And this creates a problem because he is a clear manipulator. He's the most charismatic person here. But he's second in command in favor of someone who wants Scottish independence, which had no bearing on World War One whatsoever.
Zero.
So this is when immediately the Wonder Woman allegories were already there. I know we've touched on it a bunch, but I'm starting to see Ares, where we're creating something just to create war, just because I want to. And that's not good enough.
Well, one of the things that this movie has in common with Wonder Woman beyond the setting is I think the villains are way too outlandish. And they're a huge juxtaposition against the actual World War One backdrop and battle scenes. They're not as ridiculous as Danny Houston and the Doctor, but it's up there. And
well, not all of them.
Yeah.
Some of them are.
So Rasputin and the Shepherd are definitely,
yeah,
they're ridiculous. But you have Daniel Brühl there, who is one of my favorite actors. I love him. And he's more like Baron Zemo in the comics here than he is in the actual Marvel movies.
Yes. And he might as well have just walked off the set of Civil War because he's looking and acting the exact... just wasted. Absolutely wasted.
I was disappointed that he's just here to be the sort of the spin doctor. Which one of the funny gags that I do like is Tom Hollander plays all three of the King George, the Kaiser, and the Tsar. You can have fun with that, but the movie never really does.
Yeah, but see, and that's another thing too. When you get into the history of the birthright and the cousins and that kind of stuff, it seems outlandish. No, that's true. That's history. That's what happened. And I think all that is lost. So I think those nuances, at least for American audiences, they don't mean anything.
Now, and because this movie is so loose with some of the things it chooses to depict, if you're completely ignorant to World War One whatsoever, you're going to sit there questioning just how much of this is an exaggeration. Because to your point, the fact that all three of them, that World War One, like still the highest body count in a war that's been documented, was started over cousins squabbling for power. With how it's depicted here, you would be like, surely it didn't happen that way until you do the digging and find out, oh, it actually is. So if it's trying to play as true like historical fiction, I think it kind of fails in that, but it's also not exaggerated enough to feel like a comic book movie. Or something like Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Nazis are played straight, even though you have Toth, who might as well be a cartoon, but when the supernatural stuff comes in, it also doesn't feel out of place. Here, with Rasputin, with what he can and cannot do, I think that they don't know exactly how to balance that.
Yeah, the balancing act is all over the place, as you've already mentioned, Matt. And I'm still, what are we? We're about 40, 45 minutes in. I'm still trying to figure out what I'm watching. Am I watching a historical drama? Am I watching a comic book film? Am I watching a Matthew Vaughn film? I don't know if he has a grasp on what he has written here. It's all over. And we get the Bond introductory scene, as you mentioned, of all these villains and everything. And then from there, it's just like, I'm trying to see, okay, where did we build the Kingsman? Where do we even start that? We're getting none of that. We're just getting this backstory with these characters I don't give a shit about. Move the story along. He just has it at a standstill for God knows how long until he doesn't.
Well,
I like that scene with the villains and all that. It's fun because I'm seeing it as a Bond nod, but that can't be all this is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like the absurdity of that where it's like Austin Powers, basically, where they're all so cartoonish, but it's supposed to be funny. But this lead villain, I don't give a shit about. And then when it's revealed who it is, I'm like, oh,
yeah.
If this was supposed to be impactful, it's not. And again, I just can't get over the Scottish independence. I don't know if he was trying to make a message with that, but if you know your European history, the referendums for that didn't start until like 79. I don't know, was Mel Gibson involved in this? Because I thought, okay, Matthew Vaughn must be Scottish then, or have some kind of... But no, he's English. Mm-hmm. He's from Paddington, so I don't know where this came from, because it doesn't track. And you have all the motivation you need of just, hey, we want to have be Spectre. Fuck it, we want world domination. That's all we want. You don't need this backdrop to justify World War One. Mm-hmm. Especially because the next 20 minutes, they actually recreate the Ferdinand assassination.
Yeah. Which is all to the T. This is exactly what happened. You know, I mean, look, nobody hit it like a baseball bat, hit a bomb like a baseball bat into the car behind him. But this is pretty much what happened, was it went in the second car.
Yeah, and I don't think Ralph Fiennes was there as a security.
But, yeah, you know, yeah, you get what like I was saying.
It's like when they revealed Magneto was behind the Kennedy assassination. I'm like, oh, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it was involved. Which, this movie, maybe it shows that it was a good thing Matthew Vaughn did not do Days of Future Past with that alternate history. But yeah, so as I mentioned, Orlando Conrad, they're trying to persuade Franz Ferdinand with some diplomacy. But one of the operatives, who was Gabrielo Princip, was the actual guy who committed the assassination, manages to shoot them while they're driving around. And this basically starts World War One, where we're cutting to like King George, we're cutting to the Tsar, we're cutting to the Kaiser. All of them are debating whether or not to actually... Basically, it comes down to, I don't like my cousin, F you.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it was almost that petty. Like, if you know your history, it's pretty similar to that. And you have Rasputin and you have the Danny Brühl character, who is also a real-life person, but he was much more prominent in Weimar Republic Germany. Which, we'll talk about the post-credit scene at the end of this, because I have words about that.
There's a post-credit scene?
Oh, you missed it.
I did. Oh, I had no I had no fucking idea.
I can't wait to tell you about it.
You're seeing the post-credit scene.
Oh, fuck.
That's going to make this review so much more fun, because me explaining it to you, your head is going to explode.
Oh my god. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, so they're all instigating the war. I mean, Rasputin might as well be Jafar from Aladdin. Cobra staff to hypnotize Nicholas's power because he poisons the kid, which I think did actually happen. And he tells him, if you promise to pull out of the war, I'll cure your kid. They touch on he's got them under an opium influence. Conrad gets a letter from his cousin that mentions that the Western Front is going to be in trouble if Russia leaves the war, because England will be left to fend for themselves. Because remember, America is not involved at this point.
Mm-hmm.
More on that terribly. Kitchener decides to set sail, and this is where it turns into Game of Thrones, because they just start killing people left and right, because he gets hit by... I was like, oh, finally, something happened.
Yeah.
As a result, Orlando says, all right, we have to do something, so we're going to go... I'm going to reveal to my son that we actually are a spy organization, although they never answer, where did this money come from?
Yep.
How long they've been doing this, and he's a pacifist, but he's still involved in worldly affairs that lead indirectly to war. This is the Batman problem of murder with intent versus I'm going to cripple you and likely leave you in a coma and die, but I still didn't break my no-kill rule.
And it seems like Vaughn's trying to have it both ways, because it's like, you know, well, who would possibly think this way other than somebody who purports to be a pacifist? And I'm like, well, is he trying to say that he's not really a pacifist? Is he just... he's trying to have his cake and eat it too, and you know, let them eat cake, because this needs to be written a lot better.
Oh yeah, this movie is full of shorthand writing, and this is the whole point of the movie, to explain how they came to be. Mm-hmm. And you're not even properly servicing that, because there's no like cool spy shit in this at all. Because even the espionage where they intercept the telegram, I could watch something like The Imitation Game and see that be handled better.
Especially when you're doing these little Bond nods and having fun with some of it, you could have some really cool-ass fun with early Kingsman gadgets. And to not do that is, like, what were you thinking? How do you not?
Yeah, this whole movie feels like the title, they just slapped it together, because this was the only way he could make something like this, was to tie it to an existing IP.
I wonder how much of this was like, hey, you got 2 weeks to edit this and present it to Disney, or it's getting sold off to somebody else, because they needed to close that deal.
They decide that they need to go assassinate Rasputin, so they all go to Russia. And this is kind of like the most interesting part of the movie, where it's, all right, we're going to invite him as the guest of honor, we're going to drug him and poison him with the cake. That involves you leading into a separate room. But of course, they have to have the Bond-esque hero and villain not getting along, exchanging words. And this is where they insinuate that Rasputin is a sex fiend, because he openly says he wants to fuck both of them.
That's how he says it. I know it's supposed to be creepy. It's not even fun. I know that he does this part. It didn't want to fuck your boy. Because when I see Iphans even in this, I can't help but go back to The Replacements every fucking time.
Replacements.
You know, I see him in the bar and just, he's wiry.
No, I see, what's his name, Notting Hill, Spike.
Oh, yeah.
He makes him switch seats. I thought they were actually going to fuck. There was a part of me that was like, are they really going to go this far and actually, because for all the Bond movies, you never saw him fuck a man.
You saw it teased, but you're right, it never actually happened.
I mean, that's what this is. This feels like a parody of that Skyfall
scene. Did. Yeah, I thought of that too, Matt. That's a great point.
Very much, especially when he puts his head in his lap and starts licking the wound. This is when I'm all for fun. I'm all for that. I'm not grossed out. This just goes too far that it's not funny after a little bit. It's just...
It goes on and on and on. It just won't end.
But we said that about at least one scene in all of these Kingsman films.
And sometimes it can come back around. It goes on so long that it comes around to being funny again. This doesn't. And I don't need to see Voldemort's O-face. I really don't.
Well, you can watch The English Patient if you want to see that.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess his wand chose his wizard, literally.
Now, the one thing I do like is they bring up that cyanide smells like almonds, and that's why he throws up the cake, because his Jedi powers kicked in. And he's like, I'm going to take you outside, and he tries to drown him in a frozen lake. But then the most creative and most fun fight scene in the movie actually happens here, where he's fighting all them. And if this is what we get in the John Wick ballerina movie, I may be okay.
This is fun. This scene ends fun. As soon as this happens and Strawberry Fields and who from Guardians show up, sorry, that's all I can think of, this scene turns fun with this sword play, dancing, and the music and everything else. It needed more of this. It needs this break. And we're about, 55? We're almost at the exact halfway point, and it needs this break of reality and fun.
Yeah, I agree. I'm completely with Adam. I found this scene fun, and it's the exact point where we need it. And Vaughn seems to play those exact beats a lot. You know, we've talked about it in a lot of these movies where he'll let it go for a while, and then he'll put an action scene like this in. And I guess you can consider this an action scene. It's a little bit of a fight scene, but you're always smiling. I'm always smiling when Rasputin's on screen. So when this is going on, I was smiling ear to ear here as well.
What I like the way that this scene ends is that the rumors of Rasputin's demise, that he was shot, he was stabbed, he was poisoned, and finally he was drowned. They hit every single one of those beats inside this scene. And I think that's brilliantly done. If you don't know, it means nothing. And if you know it, you're checking off boxes and smiling like I was.
Yep.
They also don't touch on him having his dick hung up in a museum, apparently.
There was sequel bait.
Yeah, so they kill him, quote unquote. But I thought he was going to come back, like be Baron Samedi, where he shows up again and you can't kill him. It wouldn't be the most ridiculous thing in these movies.
You know what, though? As soon as Rasputin's gone, so was my interest in this movie. It's like a balloon, and it got way inflated. And then once he's gone, it slowly but surely deflates. And I'm not going to say I'm not having fun after this, but it's a real chore after this character's gone to get me back into the film. And the movie never fully does.
Yeah, and I had no doubt that he wasn't coming back. Mm-hmm. I was sure he was coming back because that's what Rasputin was known for. So I was positive we were seeing him again, or that he was going to reveal that he was the big bad at the end, talking to himself or cloning or a twin brother, something outlandish that you could do in something like this. And I can't believe they don't.
Yeah, especially because he's on the poster, he's in all the marketing, but no, he's not the main villain. So big mistake, and kind of a little bit of false advertising, because the trailers don't show the shepherd guy at all, and it leads you to believe that Rasputin is the actual villain, which would make sense if you're looking at this from the context of an outlandish World War One historical elevated fantasy. But now we get to the American involvement, because the Dan Brühl character advises the Kaiser to send the Zimmermann telegram, which was basically trying to blackmail Mexico into attacking us.
Yeah.
If you know your history, the plan was, you know, it was a basic military contract where if the U.S. got involved in World War One, Germany and Mexico would align. And if they were successful, Mexico would get basically Texas, everything that we took from Mexico, they would get back. But if you also know your history, the decryption of this is one of the most important parts of espionage in the 20th century. And it's solved in 5 minutes in this movie. This could have been the actual, I don't want to call it MacGuffin, but this could have been your like framing device to explain how the Kingsmen got into Spyfare in the first place. Like they were hired, quote unquote, to decipher the telegram, which they do, but they're already in existence.
Yep, for sure. Again, Vaughn is playing so much with history here. I had completely forgotten about this whole Mexico involvement. Again, once this starts, I'm still tapped out just because I don't have Rasputin anymore.
Well, speaking of tapping out, much like the second movie, the portrayal of the American president, in this case it's actually Woodrow Wilson, is about as outlandish as what they did with Bruce Greenwood in the second movie. And I rolled my eyes every time he asked for a statesman drink.
Yeah, me too.
The first time, I was like, okay, I gave it a little nod. They hit that point like four more times.
Yep.
Yeah, it's almost like he forgot he was making a prequel, because so much of this feels entirely disconnected.
Well, he wants to give wings to what he's already done. The thing is, all that stuff hasn't happened yet, so...
Yeah, and also, if you were going to do that, then make a movie about the origin of the Statesman. Really make it a parody, because you can have fun with Europeans' view of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could have had the Statesman show up in this film to show them trade the bot. Yep.
So Wilson refuses to join the war because he doesn't believe that it's concrete enough. So they recruit. I mean, this is the freaking Legion of Doom at this point, because Lennon comes into the movie.
The Legion of Doom.
Like, it basically is. Like, this is the Masters of Evil from Marvel Comics. Like, fucking, if the Shepherd was Dr. Doom, it's like the opposite. Like I said, it's the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen for, like, historical villains.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Yep.
Because Lennon...
Meanwhile, in the Kremlin.
Yeah. If, I mean, there is a submarine, so the fact that they don't have an underwater lair surprised me. Because Lenin is the one with the October Revolution, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution. They ousted Tsar, and that's what Russia, that's how they got out of the war. And they also play with time here, because they end the movie with the Romanov family being assassinated by the photographer, even though that happens at this point, if you're paying attention to history.
Yep.
And also, that's one of the most shocking scenes of the movie, that they actually put that in. You see it in the reflection of the camera. But the fact that they show children getting shot, I was genuinely surprised.
Yeah, same. It's nice to see that Vaughn still has a set of balls on him, because I haven't seen him this entire fucking movie. But here, it's readily on display, and I'm here for it.
So Conrad, commissioned against his father's wishes, he goes into the Grenadier. The king says, yeah, I'll have him assigned to London. But Conrad chooses to switch places. Now, this was not publicized, that Aaron Taylor Johnson was in the movie.
I was looking for him. I remember you guys saying that he was in this. And I spent this entire movie looking for him. I did not see him. So this is where he shows up.
Yeah, he's the soldier that he swaps places with.
Oh, okay. All right, now it makes sense.
I don't want to say unrecognizable, because I facially know that's him. But if you weren't paying attention, you'd be like, oh, that was Aaron Taylor Johnson?
I got to tell you, like I said, I was looking for him and I didn't recognize him. So, like, even though we've seen him in, what, 3 of these films, I did not recognize him at all.
I feel like he was only here to be the main character if they ever made a World War II movie, which clearly they were setting up.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
But I got to talk about the post-credits scene.
All right. I'm sorry.
So he gives him the codename Lancelot to give his dad the message. So he takes his place. And they go into no man's land, which the next 10 minutes might as well be straight out of Wonder Woman.
You guys keep bringing up Wonder Woman.
It's that, though, I will say, this silent warfare that they do with just the knives and bayonets, because they're both trying to keep their own sides from firing, is stunning. This 5 minutes of this fight in the dark, which I'm always going to appreciate when somebody shoots something at night and I can fucking see, because so many directors and cinematographers just don't know how to light at night. I think this is awesome. It's a different movie, though. This isn't fun, but this is really gripping and engaging. And then when it backs up and you get the flares and everything else, and it kind of pans up, the shots in this scene are beautiful. It doesn't look like this film. I feel like I'm watching 1917.
Yeah, or that remake of All Quiet on the Western Front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the movie also becomes joyless after they kill off Rasputin. Yep. Like, this really does feel like multiple movies, multiple stories.
It does.
That were condensed to make this a movie. All right, and this is where we get the most contrived thing in the movie, where even though he saved this guy, he still thinks he's a German spy and they shoot him in the head and kill him off.
They don't tackle him, don't capture him, don't do anything just for shock value. So they shoot him in the head.
That nobody in this movie thinks logically.
Yeah, that's my big problem, too.
There would be an investigation. He would at least be court-martialed. Because if you suspected a spy, you would interrogate that spy, not do what Daniel... Like, this is what M criticized Bond for in Casino Royale, shooting first and not asking questions.
This is Vaughn having a bad case of prequelitis here, because things are happening just to happen to get to the end. And yeah, you're right. There's no logic in this.
No, he would be so valuable if he was a spy. But I'll say, completely caught me off guard. This shocked the hell out of me the first time I saw this.
I didn't see this coming. I mean, neither did he. That's why he died.
But you know what? I'm not going to take that as a compliment. I really don't. I'm not going to use it as a compliment to this movie. I think it's a detriment to it. Because Vaughn, he used shock value in the last 2 movies, but not to this extent, where it just basically comes out of nowhere.
I think it's very clear, especially once we're given the name Lancelot for the swap and everything else. It's clear that Conrad is going to be setting up the Kingsman He was taken to the tailor shop. He was taken everything else. So this is that whole ha ha ha. It's not what you thought it was going to be.
Yeah, and gee, that gel that they used to bring Colin Firth back to life, they really could have used that in World War I and would have saved a lot of people's lives.
Oh my God, this is another shot in the face.
Didn't we talk about that enough last week, guys? Come on.
So they do the most prototypical thing of Ralph Fiennes becoming a raging recluse alcoholic because his son died. There's no originality in this. And he gets woken up out of his depressed state because the king just happens to come by and give him the medal.
Mm-hmm. I saw Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, basically snaps out, and Wilson again refuses to enter the war, and he realizes that Wilson was blackmailed by one of the agents, and that explains, so the Zimmerman telegram happened because he got cock-blocked. Which, again, not the most flattering depiction of the executive branch of the United States.
No.
An accurate one, but not nice.
He's going for the lowest common denominator here.
So Orlando goes to the American Embassy, and this is very Bond-esque, where he notices the scarf.
Yep.
And it's also very Bond-esque because he chokes her out without any hesitation.
Mm-hmm. Which, I dig that part, because Kashmir will pass through a ring without being snagged.
Yep, except at the end, that when he's hanging off the cliff, they don't bring that back, and he lets it go.
But again, as we said, this feels different than the two-thirds we got before this. Here, this movie becomes something different than what we had leading up to this point.
Again.
Yep, again.
It's all five different movies, and none of them are great.
See, this is the problem with having roundabouts in Europe. Constant left turns. Just like this film.
Well, they also drive on the wrong side of the road.
Yep.
There's no driving because where they're going, they don't have roads because they have to go to the top of the mountain sanctuary. I mean, look, if a goddamn DeLorean showed up in this movie, it wouldn't be the most ridiculous
thing. It wouldn't be the most ridiculous thing, you're right.
And they have to parachute onto the sanctuary. And, you know, this action scene's pretty cool. Yeah. I mean, it's nothing spectacular, but the problem is, when you compare what the CGI backdrops and what's clearly Ralph Fiennes' stunt double, when you can watch stuff like John Wick and Mission Impossible, where they're doing it for real, it really loses its luster.
For sure.
And I can get a father losing his son after losing his wife, decides to put aside his pacifism for this. But this movie, just because it doesn't know what it wants to be, it decides, oh shit, we are a Kingsman film at the very end of the movie.
Yeah, and even then, his nanny and manservant don't really get much to do. At least Jaimin Huntsu gets to decapitate that guy.
they actually give Jaimin Huntsu something to do, which was shocking to me.
Which is funny, because I've been watching, not to timestamp this, but been watching Reacher Season 3, and I'm like, ooh, he has been in something else.
So they get into the sanctuary, and it's revealed that the shepherd is Morton, who was the second in command. I mean, like, when you have Matthew Good in your movie, he's pretty much going to be the villain and everything. But it's the same problem. I think he's just a bad actor, because in Watchmen, it's so clear that Ozymandias is the villain, even though it's supposed to be a fucking twist.
Yeah, I've seen Matthew Good in other things as well. I'm completely with you. He just has zero presence. He's like a lot of this cast, he doesn't have what Vaughn needs for this movie. He's just kind of here going through the motions.
This reveal is, can I use my one wrestling analogy? Because I have the perfect one. Okay. This is like when you found out Rikishi ran over Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Inconsequential.
Where you're like, okay, you can clearly tell they just wrote that on a napkin the day before because they didn't have an answer. Where I'm like, I mean, I guess, but I don't care.
And this reveal, this is when I need Hazdu to show back up from Guardians and do the who?
Yeah, I'm like, right.
Who? What? Why do I care? And just by replaying the scenes and showing that he was in each one, I still don't care. I need some mind control by Rasputin, and then maybe when he dies, that gets lost, so now he's going to continue off on his own, twisted. But he's Ares. He is starting a war for no reason than to start a war.
Well, it's also the thing of, you could have had it be Rasputin because he's bald, and the Rasputin that we see earlier, he just removes the, like, it's a fake beard and a fake wig.
But coming down to how he's playing it, every time he does it, he's Matthew Fine. He's never good in doing these performances. It's just, yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you.
Well, that was nice.
Yeah, but that has to make Ralph Fiennes Ralph exceptional by comparison. Because again, you talk about a mismatch. Even Ralph Fiennes at 60-something years old, I could buy beating this guy's ass. Mm-hmm. As he knocks him off the side of the building, which we've seen in, or the side of the cliff, which we've seen in God not even just Bond movies, count your 80s action movies, the amount of times you've seen that.
Yep. It's Cliffhanger all over again.
Oh, God, I wish we were doing Cliffhanger.
Yeah, I wish I was watching Cliffhanger. Hell, I wish I was watching Vertical Limit. That movie sucks.
It's so bad. But it's better than this one.
They also recover the film, so Wilson puts the U.S. into the war. The movie basically says, because of America, basically they should have subtitled this movie, America 2, England 0. Because we gained our independence from them, and we saved them from being conquered.
Playing the Team America theme song at this point.
I mean, look, if there was a marionette showed up as Wilson and company, I mean, that's basically what they think of us Americans.
Pretty much.
So he purchases the Kingsman Tailor Shop, and it's like the movie said, oh shit, we forgot to actually make a Kingsman prequel so quick. He's Arthur. He's Merlin.
Yep.
Stanley Tucci's fucking here.
Yeah. I was surprised to see him here.
Tucci.
You know, like I said, you got Otto Johnson here because I think he was intended to be the lead in the next movie. That's how the movie ends, but not before. Okay, this post-credit scene.
Yeah, I need to hear about this.
All right. So Garrett. So the end-credit scene is the Daniel Brühl character talking to Lennon, and he's now in charge. So he goes, we basically need to add a new member to our team since I'm in charge. So this guy walks in, and he shakes Lennon's hand, and he goes, what's your name? And he says, Adolf Hitler.
Oh, fuck.
Without the mustache?
How do you have him without the mustache?
He's got a normal mustache.
He looks like Stalin.
Yes.
My God.
These fucking idiots don't know history.
What the fuck, man?
He basically made Hitler the Thanos of this universe.
Oh my God.
I would be, like, if I'm a Jewish, I'd be, like, legitimately offended with how this is handled.
Yeah. Oh, God, I had no idea. Hitler?
Oh, I'll send you the clip. It's fucking hysterical. But, like, it's kind of infuriating, and also I would argue it's kind of insensitive. But, yeah, I was like, really? That's... I'm glad this was the post-credits scene, because if this was the actual ending of the movie, it's a good thing that very few people saw this movie in the first place, because if this was the actual last scene, I think it would have garnered a lot more controversy.
That's enraging.
But it's handled like how Marvel would do their stingers, where they introduce, like, it might as well be the ending of the Avengers where Thanos turns around and smiles. Like, it's that level of...
You mean Hellboy? He looked like Hellboy in that one.
He does. But yeah, so that's how this movie ends. Which, oh, I forgot to mention. In addition, they reveal that Hitler is the one who assassinated the Romanovs.
Oh my God. Just stop. Stop.
I'll send you the clip when we're done, because it's but that's the King's Man, which I don't think is going to score very high on these airwaves, but we'll see if anyone's going to be moderately generous. So Garrett, scale of 1 to 10.
Once again, you go to me first. If anyone wants to hear how big of a struggle it was for us to get through this film, just stay tuned through the bloopers, because there's a blooper where we pretty much just go on tangent about something completely different. And that was something that I felt while watching this film, where I pride myself on, you can ask my fiance this, I never go through my phone or anything while these movies are on, even if it's something I've seen 100 times, because I want to completely concentrate on the film and take notes as it goes. And as I was doing it for this, since I'd never seen it before this particular podcast, my mind was starting to trail off. Vaughn has just lost his grasp on what made that first film, and to a certain extent, last week's film, enjoyable. There's none of that manic energy. I was missing Taron Egerton so bad here. Hell, I was even missing Colin Firth. Really bad. And it's no offense to any of this cast. I'm also going to put a lot on the fact that Jane Goldman is in here. I think if this film displayed anything, it was how much she held Matthew Vaughn's scripts together with what she added. There is nothing here that I really enjoyed, except for Rasputin. When Rasputin was on, I was full attention. But when he leaves about a little more than the halfway point of this film, I was kind of tuned out as well, and it took everything to concentrate towards the end. They kind of gain it towards the end. You know, I think the final battle's fun. But God, Matthew Vaughn really dropped the ball with this one. And I said it earlier, and I'm going to say it again. I think this was him being more restrained, because I think he was trying to make his own version of Saving Private Ryan. I think he's trying to educate people on stuff they might have missed out on in anything World War One related. Because as I mentioned, there's nothing really interesting that happened in World War One. Yes, it was a bloody war. But the conflicts behind it, there was no Pearl Harbor for World War One. That hurts this as well. Fiennes is always fun to see, and Reza Fiennes, my God, you're a highlight of a movie. But other than that, I was pretty tuned out of this. It was pretty dull, and I'm going with the patented 4/10 with this. It was pretty tough to get through. So 4/10 for The King's Man, which, by the way, -1 point just for that title alone.
I mean, you said I don't lie that, but I've got to go to Adam next because it's in my contract.
It's amazing. This is one of those things. You know the, what is it, Screen Rant? The Things Wrong with X.
CinemaSins.
God, this movie's got a lot wrong with it. I don't know what Matthew Vaughn was thinking. I could appreciate wanting to do a prequel because a sequel seemed a little far-fetched, being that the response to Golden Circle was identical to the first one. Same financial results, lower appeasement, it seemed. So I was ready for this, but this is all over the place. It's all over the place in tone. It's all over the place in quality, both in acting and writing and stunt work, action. I mean, these are fun action spy movies. And he forgets a lot of this. The spy element is completely gone. The action element is very, very missing, except for a few little choice scenes. You cast some good actors, but everything here is just, it's not lesser, it's misguided. It swerves and then turns back around and then is up on a hill and then it does a backflip. I said it before, I feel like he filmed a 5-hour movie and chopped shit together so randomly that he lost its pacing. This movie doesn't know what it really wants to be, and that's to its detriment. I'm all for swerves, I'm all for surprises, but this doesn't feel like it was written that way. It feels like it was cobbled together that way. Maybe Dutch was a part of this war too, because I feel like my feet are cobbled the way that this film is just clunking around. It's a shame. It deserves better. It has some of the Bond elements, but then it almost laughs in its face by not following through on them. You know, we get Spectre rings and bases and villains, and then nothing follows through. We get set up with side characters that then nothing follows through. So it's disappointing. This kind of feels like Kick-Ass 2 to Kick-Ass, where if you didn't put Matthew Vaughn's name at the beginning of this, I never would have thought that he actually did this, because I feel like it is so separate from the two films we got before. You got a few cool scenes, the No Man's Land scene, but we've seen it already. Shoot, they even shot Ralph Fiennes out holding a shield, getting hit by a grenade out the barn, the exact same way that Wonder Woman gets shot out a fucking door in that film. I know we talked about it a lot, but it rips off so many visuals that it gets insulting by the end of this film. Yeah, it's too long, but even cutting it down wouldn't make this thing watchable. No, it's watchable if you enjoy the other two. Just don't expect to have a good time for completionist realms. I watched an interview where he said, oh, we set up so many things. I hope people are going to like it because we got plans for the future. Well, you know what? Plan for a good movie before you plan for the future, because you let us all down. I'm lockstep with Garrett. This is a 4/10. I had so many more expectations, and Vaughn just could not land the plane.
So he made his second Kick-Ass too, because last week we said the same exact thing where he made all the same mistakes.
And I get enjoyment out of Golden Circle because I felt that it was consistent. This one, its inconsistency is the problem.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Man, I've seen gas station bathrooms that are cleaner than this movie is. I mean, Disjointed is being kind. I mean, say what you want about Golden Circle, and we said plenty of criticisms. But at the very least, to a certain degree, you had, albeit a very straightforward plot, I mean, it might as well have been straightforward to video based on the quality, but at least it was trackable, and your main character, nowhere near as much as the first one, but still likable and still something to root for. There's not much to watch here outside of just the name, because the action scenes that are here are devoid of a lot of Vaughn's trademark style, and the spy espionage and loving tributes to Bond are very sparse to borderline non-existent. So the only reason I can't call it a disappointment is because I didn't see it in theaters. So I'm kind of glad I saw this in video, because if I went to a theater, I probably would have been legitimately, I don't know if upset's the right word, but definitely would not have been satisfied. So fuck, we're all in agreement. I hate when we do this, but it's a 4. Mm. So we're doing 3/4s leading into the fourth part of this retrospective. I mean, if you thought a prequel was cutting its loose, we're going to talk about a movie that doesn't even reveal that it's a standalone spinoff until the last mid-credit scene of the movie.
Oh my God. Okay, so I haven't seen Argylle yet. I remember it getting thrashed in reviews, but I have zero idea what to expect next week. So just give me a slight preview. What exactly are we walking into next week?
So we're walking into a movie about an author who gets drawn up into a spy story because what she wrote basically is mirroring what's happening in the real world.
Wow.
Think of it as the spy equivalent of the Pagemaster.
Is Vaughn back next week?
Yeah, Vaughn.
Vaughn's back.
Directed a new writer, though. Instead of the guy who wrote The November Man and Oblivion, they got the writer of Ice Age, Continental Drift, and Pan. in the Minecraft movie.
Wow.
Well, you answered my question of what to expect. I'm not expecting much. So...
No, you look at that cast list and you think this would be something that should... I mean, look, Henry Cavill, Bryce Dallas Howard, Sam Rockwell, Bryan Cranston. Those are some people I root for consistently. But if you think people didn't go to see The King's Man, people didn't go see Argyle because that thing didn't even crack 100 million.
Really?
And this was marketed like a son of a gun. I mean, it was in front of everything. And I remember sitting in front of movie after movie and all of us, like my family was like, you know what? That looks cute and fun. 2024, we were deep into election season. It was like, oh, I needed a relief. And this thing was in and out of theaters so damn fast, it might as well have been spoiled popcorn, because I never got a chance to see it in movie theaters.
I didn't see it in theaters. I waited until video, because to Garrett's point, this thing did not do especially well, critically or commercially. So does it deserve its reputation? Because Lord knows we've liked movies that don't have the best critical reaction. It's also not technically a Kingsman movie proper. And we'll expand on that next week. So until we review Argyle next week, boys, reputation is what people think of you. Podcast is what you are.
I know what you're going to say. I should be proud of myself because I'm finally using my gift for something important.
No, I was just going to tell you your fly was down for the whole show.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Congratulations. Bloody well done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You're right about the snobs, but there too, there are exceptions.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Pretty fucking great.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
Ooh, I'm living dangerous. What you did, I'll make you pay for it. See, I know that you're scared.
How was that? Not so bad. Kind of fun, huh?
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon films, the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Words to live by, Eggsy. Words to live by.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
As long as your heart's in the right place, we don't care what you put in your mouth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I feel like a tornado in a trailer park.
Scheduling done by Matt.
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without sounding like a complete idiot right now.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Playtime's over, kid.
I never play.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
What the fuck are you doing here? You taking a piss?
The Freeman and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You really believe in all this?
I believe that when a man's chest becomes an insect's palace, when his eyes are gone and his limbs ain't there no more, when I'm so scared I want to handcuff myself to my bed to keep from coming to work, yeah, I believe it, man. I believe I don't want to die, Sheriff.
Shows over, motherfuckers.
Well, it became okay to do World War One because Wonder Woman showed you could do it and people would go see it.
True, and so did Dunkirk, you know, but honestly...
No, that was World War Two.
Was that World War Two? I thought that was World War One.
No, that's World War Two.
That was 1917. That was World War One. No, maybe that's the movie I was thinking of was 1917.
Yeah, you're thinking of 1917.
Yeah. So I got those two confused. Yeah, 1917.
And we got the writer of Adam's favorite movie, Oblivion, and...
I almost spit out my coffee.
and the November Man, which is...
Oh my God.
And I don't need to see Voldemort's O-face. I really don't.
Well, you can watch The English Patient if you want to see that.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess his wand chose his wizard, literally.
That's right, there's two Harry Potter alumni, because people forget Recycles was in Harry Potter.
Yes.
Was he really?
He's in the second to last one. He plays Luna's dad.
No kidding.
Garrett's like, I forgot even.
I forgot. It's been so long since we did that series. I completely forgot.
You look at it, I can tell you Michael Caine's in those movies and you'd believe it. He's like, wait, he wasn't? Now, the one thing I do like, and he gets woken up out of his depressed state because the king just happens to come by and give him the medal.
Mm-hmm. I saw Dark Knight Rises. Dark Knight Rises,
he has a bad knee.
Yep.
Well, that should have been one of the Kingsman gadgets. He puts on that magic
knee brace
that lets Wayne punch through rocks.
You know, it all goes back to Michael Caine.
Sidebar here, guys. We had just gone through Sharp Objects on HBO Max. I don't know if you guys have watched that show with Amy Adams.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah, it's a moment.
It's a fantastic show. But when it was over, like, I had asked her, I said, have you seen The Fighter? She said, no, I've never seen it. So we watched The Fighter. I showed her The Fighter the other day. And watching that, I just could not believe that Christian Bale went from that to being Batman. Like, the very next film.
No, that thing puts on weight and loses weight like it's nothing.
It is so unhealthy. The guy's going to...
Then he became Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
After that.
Oh my God. I'm sorry to put off track, but it threw me off seeing him. I was like, wait a second. Okay, so 2 years later was Dark Knight Rises. Yeah, this was right before that.
Yeah, because he had to slim down after the Dark to do that. Then he bulks back up. Yeah. Then he just gets fat to be Dick Cheney.
He does a Terminator film.
Yeah, yeah, in between, yeah. Well, that was right before that, though.
Yeah, well, he was still, like, buffed up for Terminator.
Just
they were so close. But the funny thing was, sidebar, because this movie's not that interesting.
Yeah.
He also he gained too much weight for Batman Begins, and Nolan told him to slim down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the suit. Between the like initial costume fitting, and then they were just like, ah, shit.
Yeah.
Somebody should have told that to Ben Affleck on Justice League. basically snaps out, and you could have had it be Rasputin because he's bald, and the Rasputin that we see earlier, he just removes the, like, it's a fake beard and a fake wig, and this is like the real.
It was me, Austin. It was me all along. That's mine.
You know, that was the obvious one I could have gone to. I guess you could have also thrown it when Bischoff drove the Hummer.
Stop, guys.
But yeah, I mean, it's
a lot of bad drive-bys in the world of professional wrestling.
But coming down to how he's.
All right. Well, thank
you. Since you're on the airwaves with us, I'm sending you the Hitler post-credit scene now so you can watch this and get your live reaction.
Oh, you want a live reaction? Okay. Let me.
And then we're going to do Argyle and Running Man?
Argyle and Running Man, yeah.
Okay, because I'm 3.5 episodes into that fucking long-ass miniseries that I'm pissed off about on CBS. 9 fucking hours?
Yeah, I'm sorry. All right, let's see what we got here.
Now it's time to address the balance of my new flock, thanks to you, comrade.
Oh my god, the audio's making me roll my eyes.
What the fuck? Oh my god.
A shepherd. This young man will come to rival your position in this world, my friend. It is an honor.
I'm watching the credit scene for Falcon and Winter Soldier.
And your name? Adolf Hitler.
Oh, fuck. For fuck's sake. Oh my god. Jesus Christ. I'll include that as a blooper on the Kingsman.
Like, it literally is one of the worst post-credits.
Oh, that is awful. That is awful.